Do you find yourself shaking your fist at the same old political talking heads? Well, stop. Join Kelly Goff, Josh Barrow, Gene Sperling, and thinkers from across the political spectrum for a live Left, Right, and Center. On October 20th, we'll turn your political frustration into fun. Don't go it alone this election year. Join us at the beautiful theater at the Ace Hotel in downtown L.A. For $15 tickets, go to kcrw.com/LRCLive.
Proposition 64 will allow marijuana smoking ads in prime time and on programs with millions of children and teenage viewers.
And Prop 64 bans advertising directed at kids, requires strict product labeling, childproof packaging, and bans edibles that appeal to children.
Fatalities doubled in marijuana-related car crashes after legalization in Washington state.
And Prop 64 generates $1 billion in new tax revenue for California.
You do not have to be pro-marijuana to be pro-legalization.
Prop 64. They got it wrong again.
Ads for and against Prop 64, the measure that legalizes recreational use of marijuana for people who are 21 years and older. If Prop 64 passes, you could grow up to 6 plants in your home. You could possess 28 grams of marijuana, but you could only smoke it or eat it in a private home or a place permitted for that. You can't do it in public. You can't do it while you're driving. Recent polling shows that voters support the measure by a wide margin. But surprisingly, maybe some of the people who stand to make the most money from Prop 64 have some reservations. Growers are split on the proposition, as are some dispensary owners. And so we asked a couple of dispensary owners to come in and talk about it. We'll speak with them in just a moment. But first, let's speak with Bo Kilmer, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center and co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know, to find out what exactly is in this bill. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, if Prop 64 passes, what can we envision? Is it going to be something like bars, you know, everywhere that serve alcohol, or will there just be a few special places where you can go smoke weed? What will it look like with legalized pot?
A lot will depend on the decisions made by the local jurisdictions. Proposition 64, if it passes, it does allow local jurisdictions to give out licenses for marijuana bars. So you could have, you know, you could have a street, you could have some bars that are serving, you know, drinks, and you could have other bars that are just serving marijuana. You wouldn't be able to license a facility that would sell both marijuana and alcohol.
Okay, so it would depend on where you lived.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's easy. What about the taxes? How much money is California expected to bring in if it passes?
Well, the Legislative Analyst Office produced a report in December, and their takeaway is that over time, the net additional state and local tax revenues could potentially range in the high hundreds of millions of dollars to over $1 billion annually, but that's eventually after the system gets set up. But what you have to keep in mind, though, when you're making these revenue projections is you have to be very skeptical of those that make long-term projections. Because, you know, while California is having this debate and, you know, other states have legalized, you know, this is still all illegal under federal law. And if the federal government eventually legalizes marijuana and you could produce it in one place and transport it throughout the country, you know, you could really have most of the marijuana that's consumed in the United States, you could have it concentrated in a, you know, a small number of places. A colleague of mine estimated that that you could produce all of the THC, the intoxicating cannabinoid in marijuana, that you could produce all of the THC that's consumed in the United States probably on 25 farms in Iowa. So the short-term implications, especially with respect to the revenue, could be very different than how this plays out in the long run.
All right, let me bring in two dispensary owners. Brett Vapnick joins me in the studio. He is from Studio City, has a dispensary there. Hello.
Hello.
And also Lynette Davies. She has a dispensary in Sacramento. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Hello.
All right, let's begin with you, Lynette. Now, you are opposed to Proposition 64, I believe. And
I am.
Even though you could potentially make money off this?
Very much so. And I will make money off of it if it goes into effect because I have a permitted shop in the city of Sacramento. But it won't be because I didn't warn you ahead of time, especially for patients. Financially wise, right now, cannabis has gone down since 2005 when I opened my shop to where we are today, considerably down. However, with Prop 64 bringing in another 15% excise tax, bringing in a $9.25 cultivation tax. The city has a 4% excise tax. We have an 8.5% sales tax. We have permit fees right now of $12,600 a year, which could go up. We have all of these fees go back to the patient base. Patients live on Social Security, disability, because they are sick and ill. And there's been no real resources that are out there for them. This could price life-saving medicine right out of the field for them. But it will open the door to the regular market, which is by far recreational use would be willing to pay much higher than what a patient has the ability to pay.
Okay, so Brett, let me bring you in on that. What about your patients? Would they be paying too much? Would it be out of their reach?
I think initially they'd be paying more because of the taxes that Lynette's talking about. I mean, it's adding, in the city of L.A., we pay a 6% tax, and this adds 15%, as Lynette was saying. So we're nearly 30% just in taxes once you add the Prop 64 tax. But as you've seen in Colorado and certainly in Washington and Oregon, the allowable production reduces the wholesale price of cannabis tremendously. You know, in Colorado, it's dropped by almost 40%, I believe, this year since they started allowing large-scale commercial production. And I think the same thing will be even more true in California.
So as I understand it, Bo, after 5 years, big corporations can come in, but there's a five-year protection window for small owners?
Well, I mean, it depends on your definition of big. I mean, right now, regardless of what happens in November, the California medical marijuana market is undergoing massive changes because we are now in the process of creating statewide regulations for medical. And with those statewide regulations, it would limit the size of production facilities. So if you wanted to grow outdoors, you could only grow up to an acre, indoors up to a half an acre. If Proposition 64 passes, it would kind of continue that for the first 5 years. But after 5 years, that cap would be removed, and you could potentially have some much bigger grows throughout the state.
Yeah, but my feeling is that, and if you know, I'm involved in cultivation indoor and outdoor, as well as having a dispensary. And a one-acre outdoor facility just over the single summer crop without any kind of, you know, more advanced growing methods can produce, you know, 2 tons of cannabis on 1 acre. And that amount of production is, you know, 100 of those farms would be a massive oversupply for the entire state. And we're in a place, unlike Colorado or Washington, where it's the ideal growing environment. I mean, it's California. This is where the entire, you know, marijuana industry started, Northern California, Central Valley. We have a production facilities up in Santa Barbara County. I mean, it's ideal for this type of cultivation. So the supply numbers, once it all has to go through a legal regulated system, I think will drive down the cost tremendously. And we're probably in the, you know, $2,000 a pound wholesale market now in that range. And I think it'll be, you know, maybe a third of that in 5 years.
Okay. So, Lynette, you're concerned about the price and supply and demand issues still being worked out. What are your other concerns?
Well, a lot of it is a criminal justice. Let's take a look at the criminal justice aspect of it. One of the things that it does do is that those people between the ages of 18 and 21, right now, if you're caught with cannabis for any reason, you have a $100 fine if it's an ounce or under. And that's a pretty much a protection for those particular people. If Proposition 64 passes, there can actually be other criminal penalties that are attached to it if it's for cultivation. And as far as just for personal use, they'd be looking at doing community service hours, I believe 10 community service hours, and they'd be looking at drug diversion classes. I don't think that is a legalization. I think we're going back into the drug war type of mentality where they've done something incredibly wrong by using cannabis between the ages of 18 and 21. Also, if you're taking a look at cultivation, they could do as much as 16 months or 2 to 3 years in jail, depending on what they were cultivating and how much they were cultivating. That's not a legalization.
And Bo, what has happened in Colorado with this issue? I understand that the arrest rates for Black and Latino kids have gone up after legalization.
Well, overall, marijuana possession arrests have gone down in Washington and Colorado. But yeah, Recently, a Colorado government agency put out some numbers, and they were looking at the marijuana offense rates for youth aged 10 to 17 by race and ethnicity. And you saw that for white youth aged 10 to 17, I believe that the marijuana offense rate went down somewhere around 10%. It did go down. But for Hispanic youth, it went up somewhere around 20%. And for African-American youth, it was closer, maybe even exceeded 50%.
58,
yeah. And I have to say that I think this caught everyone on all sides of the debate by surprise. And so I haven't seen any rigorous analyses really trying to figure out what's happening. But I do think it's important to also to look at what's happening in other places. I mean, this is happening in Colorado, but what's happening in Washington? What's happening in Oregon? And I don't know if anyone's looked at that yet, but this should be a high priority.
Brett, does it worry you that there isn't a lot of information about what will happen when it becomes legal?
You know, this is not something like it's some brand new product that someone invented and the culture doesn't have any experience with it. I mean, marijuana, especially in California, is a pretty prevalent thing. It's out there. It's people sort of feel it's de facto legalized already because of the availability, especially in a place like Los Angeles. I think it's better for society if the kids are between 18 and 21 and they have an actual medical recommendation, then these rules and things don't apply to them. But if they're under 21, just like as if they were caught with alcohol under 21, there's going to be penalties and things for that. So it's interesting because you have people coming from across the country. They come to a store like mine, you know, and it's like they're in like an alternate universe compared to where they're coming from. So it's harder for me because it's so normalized here to see that it would cause a dramatic impact in this state.
And the penalties that you mentioned, Lynette, are they more severe than if you're caught with alcohol?
Well, if you're caught to alcohol, you're not probably going to go to jail for 16 months or 2 to 3 years. So, yeah, I would definitely consider that a higher risk. But all of your rules and regulations are made so that people have permits and areas to be able to use cannabis. That involves a lot of money. People of color, people of low social economic resources are going to be incredibly hit if Proposition 64 goes through. And it looks like we're taking a good deal of the tax revenue and putting it directly into enforcement. And we're going to be enforcing that against these particular people that won't be a part of this regulatory system.
Brett, it'll still be illegal federally. Mm-hmm. And so are you worried that with this influx of cash, if it's made legal in California, that you or anyone else could be the target for robbery or any other crime?
Well, I mean, it's more, to me, the normalization of cannabis and the passage in a place like California is what will drive the change in federal legalization. And that, to me, is the ultimate goal. We deal with things as dispensary owners with the ability not to be able to deduct normal business expenses, and that really is what drives up the tremendous cost of operating these businesses. And so many people say it, but as California goes, so goes the country. My other fear is I'm all for the medical use. I have a lot of patients that come in looking for, you know, specific relief from pharmaceuticals because of the, you know, damage that's done to them and not wanting to be part of that. And the FDA control over the substance. There's a company called GW Pharma, which is in late-stage trials. They're trying to turn it into a FDA-regulated drug. So the sooner we can get recreational usage out there, the less stranglehold I feel that the pharmaceutical industry will have over cannabis and its future in California and the country.
And Bo, what happens if it becomes legal federally? What happens to the market here in California and in other states?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, if it's legalized federally, you're going to be able to address these banking issues. There are also issues surrounding the role that state agencies can play in testing the materials and handling them. But as I said, you don't need a lot of space to produce all of the THC that's consumed in the United States. And so it's quite possible that the market could concentrate quite quickly. and, you know, maybe in California, maybe somewhere else. But in the process of doing that, and this is something that Brett alluded to, you're going to continue to see the production and the distribution costs just go down dramatically. I mean, a lot of what you're paying for when you're buying marijuana is you're paying for the risk of arrest, risk of incarceration. That goes away with legalization. But also, as we're able to take advantage of increasing returns to scale and changes in technology, those production costs are just going to go down.
Yeah, and I think we're several years away from even any type of federal movement. I mean, you know, not knowing what's going to happen in the election in a couple of weeks, but assuming it goes the way it's predicted, I think we're 5 to 7 years away from any real large federal move. And to me personally, I think it would be similar to the way that the alcohol is regulated, where individual states and municipalities control licenses, places that can be operate, distribution, rules and regulations as far as distribution. Every state has its own regulations. I don't think that interstate commerce in cannabis is, I think we're, you know, 10 years away from that on a federal level.
And one last thought from you, Lynette, on the way that this proposition is structured and who controls what. As I understand it, it's very locally controlled. Is that a good thing or not?
That's a bad thing. That's a bad thing because we have, instead of having a predictable statewide system, this creates a patchwork all the way across the state, which is inconsistent. So what rules are in Sacramento County will be different that's in Placer County, that's different in El Dorado County. Every single city or county will have different rules and regulations. And that makes it incredibly difficult across the state to even implement. And it also puts people at risk because they don't know they're even breaking a rule. You might be fine in Sacramento, but you're not fine in Placer. And that even has to do with delivery services, because now they've actually putting ordinances out that say delivery services can't even go into a certain area for a sick and ill patient. And the other thing you'd have to take a look at, if we've had this many issues trying to get medicine to patients, do you really think these areas that are already closing their doors to cannabis are going to open their doors for recreational? No. We're allowing very few areas within the state of California to become very wealthy, but we're actually taking other areas and making it criminal.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Lynette Davies owns CannaCare Dispensary in Sacramento. Brett Vapnick owns Perennial Holistic Dispensary in Studio City. And Beau Kilmer is co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center and co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think? Have you decided if you're voting for or against Prop 64? What are your thoughts, pro and con? You can weigh in on our Facebook page or on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, WikiLeaks says it has 50,000 emails from Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, John Podesta. We'll find out what of note is in the 15,000 released so far, including a back and forth over Mayor Garcetti. That's next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has promised to dump thousands more hacked emails from the Clinton campaign in the coming weeks. For the last week and a half or so, WikiLeaks has dropped a new batch of emails every day. They come from the private Gmail account of Clinton campaign chief John Podesta. So far, we've seen juicy political gossip, behind-the-scenes strategy sessions, and Podesta's secret for cooking the perfect risotto. But it's been a deluge of information that we mere mortals could not hope to comb through. 15,000 emails so far. So we asked Politico senior reporter Josh Gerstein to help us out. Hi, Josh.
Hey, Madeline. Good to be back with you.
Good to have you back. Well, what is the latest that we've learned as of today?
Well, the latest I would say we learned today was a long list for vice president. This was something that was circulated by the Podesta and other people inside the Clinton campaign in March, and it's an interesting list. you know, the names sort of at the top, I guess, are not that surprising, but there's some interesting folks on there. Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, Microsoft founder Bill Gates is on the list. Howard Schultz of the Starbucks coffee fame. So it's sort of in the amusing political gossip category. I think the chances of any of them being selected were very, very low. But it's interesting to see this list of, I'm counting about 40, nearly 40 names that they were wrestling with as they sort of embarked on the VP selection process before ending up with a much, much, I think, safer and traditional choice of Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia.
Right. And he puts them, he calls them food groups. He puts them in different groupings, these possible candidates, including our mayor, Eric Garcetti, is in one of the food groups.
Right. So you look at some of these groups probably based on whether people are career politicians, local, national. There's three former military leaders here on the list, John Allen, Bill McRaven, Mike Mullen, former high-ranking military officers, as well as many of those business people that I mentioned before.
Right. Well, one of the biggest revelations we've heard so far has been her paid speeches to bankers in which she spoke about her attitudes toward a global trade, for example, and intervening secretly in Syria. Tell us about that. Any smoking guns that will come back to haunt her?
No, there's no no smoking guns there, but the tone she used in some of these speeches is probably not the same as the tone she's been taking on Wall Street, especially when she was under pretty regular fire from Bernie Sanders during the primary campaign. She talks a lot in the speeches about really needing Wall Street to figure out how to regulate itself, and that only people from Wall Street can really deliver whatever medicine is necessary. In another speech, she talks about the fact that some people have gone too far in blaming Wall Street bankers for the financial downturn of 2007 and 2008. So it's mostly what I would say is a tonal issue, but there was nothing terribly shocking. She talks about a variety of topics, like you mentioned, that I think she had a fairly forward-leaning thoughts on Syria about the way the U.S. could have been a little bit more assertive in trying to wrestle that situation, which has spiraled further and further out of control since she left office. And there's even some discussion in there about her being very aware of the cyber threats she faced every time she went out of the country regarding her communications, which for her to bring that up sort of spontaneously with people is kind of interesting, given the huge controversy we've been through in the last year and a half or so about her use of a private email system and server during that time when she served as Secretary of State.
Okay, so I want to get to that because there's a story out this week about Hillary Clinton's emails and how they were classified, and it involves the State Department, the FBI, and an alleged quid pro quo. And President Obama addressed that today in a news conference. I just want to play a clip of tape of him talking about that.
With respect to the State Department and the FBI reports, I think you've heard directly from both the FBI and the State Department that the notion or the accounts that have been put out there are just not true. You know, you can question them again, but based on what we have seen, heard, learned, some of the more sensational implications or appearances, as you stated them, aren't based on actual events.
Okay, so just to be clear, this is not part of the WikiLeaks dump we've been talking about. This is the FBI released this. What's the story here?
Right. So this is part of two other dumps, one being the dumps of Hillary Clinton's private emails, which she turned over to the State Department, were then released through authorized channels at the State Department as part of Freedom of Information Act suits that were filed. And then there's also been another layer on top of that of how the FBI conducted their investigation into how Hillary Clinton handled her emails. And this is actually, I think, in that latter category. We're now seeing documents about how that process was run. And it turns out, we're not surprised that at various points in the process, there's been conflict between Hillary Clinton as much as the State Department and other government agencies about how much of that information should be shared with the public and how much of it was classified. And according to what came out over the weekend in one of these reports, somebody at the FBI indicated that they felt a top official at the State Department by the name of Pat Kennedy had proposed a kind of exchange or compromise if FBI would back off on its request to have one of these emails classified, that the State Department would add more slots for FBI personnel in Baghdad and maybe another a couple other dangerous spots around the world where it's difficult for them to get authorized slots at U.S. embassies for security reasons. So the tricky part here is that the State Department says Mr. Kennedy never made such a proposal, and I think the president may have overstated a bit when he sort of said there was nothing to it, this didn't happen. The FBI isn't saying that it wasn't proposed. In fact, there appear to be a couple of FBI officials saying something like this was proposed. What the FBI is saying is there was never any deal. They insisted that the document be classified, and I think the slots they were requesting, they didn't receive either.
And is there some confusion over who may have proposed the quid pro quo if that was indeed proposed?
There's a little bit of confusion because the FBI appears to acknowledge that they were the ones who raised this in a conversation with Mr. Kennedy. We don't know the names of all the FBI officials involved, but that he called to discuss this classification issue, or he asked for a call to discuss the classification issue. And while he was on the phone with this person at the FBI, the person at the FBI brought up the fact that they had this other pending request regarding staffing overseas. And that person then reported within the FBI that Kennedy had proposed a linkage here. So it's a little confusing if the FBI brought it up that the linkage would have actually come from the State Department. I guess it's possible, but the State Department is vehemently denying it and denying that they ever sought to make the two things part of a compromise. And indeed, it is the case that that email was released with the classified part taken out, and folks may wonder, well, who really cared? I think at that point there was a hope, both among Clinton partisans and folks at the State Department, that the number of classified emails here could be kept to a bare minimum, where people might say, okay, there was a fluke where we had one or two such emails, and in the end, it ended up being, depending on how you want to count, perhaps 100 or 200, up to 2,000 emails that the State Department ultimately designated as classified. So this may have been something that was a concern very early, but having a big fight over one probably doesn't make a lot of sense in retrospect.
All right. It's adding to the whole email story that doesn't seem to be going away. Josh Gerstein, senior reporter for Politico, thanks for joining us.
Okay, anytime.
All right, we want to hear from you. Have you been keeping up with the ins and outs of all these email stories, with the WikiLeaks stories? What has been the most interesting revelation to you, or do you just not care? Let us know on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how an African-American kid who grew up in a violent, poor household became one of the country's best opera singers.
The story, in part, is about Ryan Shearwell. And it's just a reminder to us all, I think, of what we have inside of us.
From Trailer Park to the Metropolitan Opera House, that's next on Press Play.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Ryan Speedo Green grew up in a trailer park in southeastern Virginia. His dad was gone. His mom often beat him and his brother. When he was just 12 years old, Ryan spent time in a juvenile detention center for threatening his mother with a knife. His childhood did not set him up for much of a future. So it's really a miracle that Ryan saved himself, and in a most unlikely way.
Oh,
Ryan Speedo Green grew up to become a gifted opera singer. When he was 24 years old, he beat out 1,200 other singers in a national opera competition. And now Ryan is a star at one of the most prestigious opera houses in the world, the Met, in New York City. The story of Ryan's journey from Trailer Park to Opera House is the topic of a new book by Daniel Bergner. It's called Sing for Your Life, A Story of Race, Music, and Family. And Daniel Bergner joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline. It's great to be talking with you.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin at the beginning and talk about Ryan's early life. He grew up in southeastern Virginia, as I said, and just describe what his early childhood was like.
So he barely knew his father. Saw him just a few times until he was an adult. Very volatile, violent relationship in the home with his mom. Grew up in a trailer park, and when his mom could no longer afford the payments there, grew up in barely a house. It was really a shack directly across the street from a drug dealer's headquarters. Spent time along the way in Virginia's juvenile institution of last resort after threatening his mom's life when he was 12. Spent time in the seclusion cells of that facility. But when I first met him, there he was in the semifinals of the Met contest to find the most promising opera singers in America. This was back in 2011. And so I was covering the Met's contest for the New York Times Magazine at the time, and I had spoken to all the semifinalists, all except one, Ryan Speedo Green. He didn't seek me out in any way to talk. He really thought he had nothing to offer and wasn't expecting to even get to the finals. So he hadn't even brought his tuxedo to New York. The finals are a formal concert at the Met. So it took quite a while to find him, get to know him. No one at the Met was saying, hey, Ryan Speedo Green might win. You better get to know him. He's going to have a real career. You know, as he tells it, I asked him for 45 minutes over lunch just out of curiosity. That lunch went on for 3 hours, and then that conversation extended for years.
Mm-hmm. What was his first experience with opera? How did he first become exposed to it?
So the story, in part, is about Ryan's sheer will, and it's just a reminder to us all, I think, of what we have inside of us. But it is also about a couple of very inspiring teachers. So I hope we'll get to talk about both, but to leap forward to the second. So pretty much by luck, no one was seeing great talent in Ryan as a 15-year-old. He'd gotten out of the institution because there weren't enough boys applying to this school of the arts. He gets into this school of the arts, into its classical voice program, and is about to be booted out. He gets taken under wing by an African-American voice teacher who basically just takes over his life and takes him on a school trip to the Met. So from southeastern Virginia, travels to the Met, and happens to see an African-American mezzo-soprano, Denise Graves, singing in the role of Carmen. His African-American teacher takes him backstage to meet her. She gives him a hug, calls him her boo, and he is absolutely smitten and declares that he's going to sing at the Met someday. At the time, he couldn't even read music. But that is what set him on this path.
It was instantaneous.
It was pretty instantaneous. He was really about to fail out of this school. He was just not, you know, able to keep up with the other kids. But it was this overwhelmed feeling he describes when he heard the music combined with the identification with Denise Graves that really set him on this path. And from there, he was just absolutely determined and yet constantly making up for lost time. I should make clear, you know, when he gets to the Met contest, this is now when he's flashing forward to when he's 24, you know, he feels utterly like he doesn't belong. Most of the young singers there, you know, have been studying all but their whole lives, some since 7, since 8 years old. They're at the most prestigious conservatories, Juilliard, and yet there's just this relentless will to rise above the obstacles that have been thrown in his path since really the age of 4.
Yeah, and he goes back to his home and people are, you know, they're saying, what, are you trying to be white? And they're just mocking him for it, and he just perseveres on that end as well. So he's got to fight two battles on either end, right? I mean, he's got to fight at home, and he's also got to fight at places, you know, that he's never lived in before and expectations that people have of him. So does he know where he gets this will, where it comes from? Or?
Well, let me say first, you're touching on one of the things that most drew me to the story, which is that it was a lens on race in America that we hadn't really seen before. So you're absolutely right that, of course, in his mostly African-American neighborhood, people are not only mocking him, they're, you know, really harassing him for taking this path. And yet, as a black singer in a predominantly white art form, he'll say, and other black singers, there aren't many who are at his level, but there are a few, will say that, you know, the preconceptions that come with color get in the way of being heard. There are all sorts of thoughts in the back of casters' minds. You know, is he too gospel-y sounding, too grainy sounding? Is this right for opera? So he sort of faces these obstacles from both sides, yet, and here's what's so intriguing, just is so determined to sing past race in a way to sort of transcend race through the beauty and power of his voice. You know, as for where he gets this will, I'd say, you know, imagine the difficult home he was in, the volatility and the violence. Imagine being a 12-year-old in an isolation cell. You survive that, you're going to survive almost anything so long as you find a direction. And fortunately, he did find this powerful artistic direction.
Yeah, I mean, as I was reading it, I was writing notes in it saying, what if he hadn't come across these teachers, the one you mentioned and one earlier, Mrs. Hughes, when he was in grade school? What if he hadn't had those teachers? And it sort of is happenstance, just luck in a way that he crossed their paths and they crossed his.
Yeah, I mean, the first of these teachers, so this is before he's locked up, he's put in a classroom for the six or seven most out-of-control elementary schoolers in the entire school district. He's still remembered by his elementary school principal, you know, who's had a 42-year career, and she remembers vividly Ryan and how out of control he was, how violent he was in the classroom. But Mrs. Hughes, she just refused to give up on him. He threw his desk at her on the first day, said he wasn't going to learn from a white woman. She told him, okay, you can learn from the floor since that's where the desk is. And then she made those six or seven kids memorize the I Have a Dream speech. And, you know, Ryan refers back to that to this day, sees himself as, he hopes, living out that dream, that standard in his own small way.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Daniel Bergner about his new book, Sing for Your Life. It's about rising opera star Ryan Speedo Green. One of the anecdotes that really illustrates what you were talking about earlier about the difficult and delicate situation that he has to contend with when it comes to race is when, after he's become a star and he's successful at the Met, he is asked to sing in a donor's place in New York City, a big apartment, and he brings a song that he has prepared. I think it was a Broadway show tune. And then he's asked to sing another song. He doesn't have another song, so he tries to beg off. And then the black piano player says, sing Old Man River. Can you talk about that and what happens next?
Yeah, and I'm so glad you asked about this. So many of us know Old Man River, and it's a song sung by the character of Joe in Showboat. Joe is African-American. He works in the sort of sweaty underbelly of this boat that goes up and down the Mississippi during the Jim Crow era. And he sings a song about sort of the near slavery of his life and how he longs for the peace of death and the afterlife. And, you know, it's a terribly sad song of resignation that's sung beautifully by Paul Robeson, by other great African-American singers. But Ryan persistently will sing beautiful classical or operatic pieces at recitals or at gatherings like the one you're referring to. And then people will say, white people will say, oh, can't you sing Old Man River? And it torments him because it's as though Mahler doesn't matter, Verdi doesn't matter. What he feels is that what white people over and over again want is to sort of put him back inside this racial box of big, brawny black man. He's 6'5", by the way, singing about his terribly compressed, lost life. And he wants to live his life in this big, expansive, transcendent, beyond racial way. And that's not to say, he identifies very intensively as African American. He's very, very proud of that. But he wants to arrive and to have us arrive at a new vision. And he's consistently put back inside this box. So it's a really sad scene amid, I think, ultimately a triumphant journey.
Right. And so now he's singing this fall. He's singing in La Boheme, right, at the Met?
Yeah, he is singing a wonderful role. He sings the second to last aria in this really sentimental, sad opera, which is one of perhaps the most popular at the Met. It's a great breakthrough. He's been singing in Vienna for the past couple of years, which is, again, like the Met, one of the top five opera houses in the world. It's, you know, it's just this tremendous testament, like I said, to Will. And it's also interesting because, you know, in a lot of the operas he's really thrived in, he plays these wonderfully charismatic comic characters. And he did, because of his singing, actually managed to have a kind of reunion with his father and found that his father, although his father's tiny and Ryan's gigantic, his father has this wonderful comedic and charismatic personality. And so it's almost as though he's sort of channeling his father's spirit when he plays some of these roles.
And his name, his middle name, Speedo, Ryan Speedo Green, that's from his dad.
It sure is. His dad was a bodybuilder and loved to pose in, you know, Speedo bathing suits. So his father bequeathed him the middle name Speedo, and Speedo, as a tribute to his father, often goes by that middle name.
And his dad has died. What is his relationship with his mother like now?
You know, his relationship with his mother is difficult, as you can imagine, given their past. But here's the thing about his mom that Ryan certainly recognizes, I've come to recognize. Like, when they were living across the street from those drug dealers, and it was really, really dangerous. I mean, right across the street. And they were not happy that anyone even moved into that house and would often threaten Ryan. You know, his mom has tremendous physical courage and would, like, run out into the street to get between the dealers and their henchmen and Ryan. So that's a long way to say Ryan and his mom are rebuilding a relationship. It's very slow and very difficult, but I think it will happen.
And so now Ryan lives in New York. He's married, right?
Yeah, he has a wonderful wife. They had a dream wedding. And actually, he's living in New York as he's singing in Boheme, but largely lives in Vienna because he does more roles there at this point.
And he is happy and satisfied with his life and all his dreams are fulfilled?
He is happy with his life and he's this radiant person. The other thing to point out, he's just turned 30. He is really, really young for his voice type. His potential will be unknown for easily another 10 years, if not longer. It's a sort of quirk of the way big voices like his develop. So he's got bigger dreams, dreams of singing Wagner that, you know, we just won't know whether they'll be realized. I think they will be, you know, for another decade.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for telling this story. It was fantastic.
Thanks, Madeline.
That's Daniel Bergner, the author of the new book, Sing for Your Life, A Story of Race, Music, and Family.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The breakfast burrito is an LA staple, but the breakfast taco is quickly gaining ground on its cousin, the burrito. It is the battle you didn't know about between two delicious tortilla-wrapped meals, and LA eaters have surprisingly strong feelings about it. And here to tell us more is Catherine Spires, food editor for the LA Weekly. Hi.
Hi.
I didn't know that that would elicit so much passion.
Oh, you know, it's one of these things that has to do with regionality, it has to do with pride of place, and it's a food issue where people tend to confuse their opinions for facts.
Oh, so, yes.
Yeah, so a lot of riled up people on the burrito.
That happens a lot with food. Okay, so you took a Twitter poll on the subject, a highly scientific Twitter poll.
Yes, yeah, very rigorous standards. I said breakfast burritos or breakfast tacos. 75% went for breakfast burritos. 25% said breakfast tacos were where it's at. I would like to say that that's a slam dunk, but we do have to think about the fact that probably most of my Twitter followers are California-based.
So they would go for the burrito.
Yeah, we're just kind of more, well, it's complicated. I was about to say we're a burrito culture. Los Angeles isn't in the way that San Francisco and San Diego are, except for when it comes to the breakfast burritos. We're real passionate about those.
Well, I honestly didn't know there was a breakfast taco.
Right. And I would say that until very recently, a lot of people outside of Texas did not.
Okay. So describe that.
So the breakfast taco is an element of Tex-Mex cuisine. Some of the things that make it a taco are that it's the main filling is eggs. There's sometimes a little bit of meat, never rice. Sometimes a bean and cheese breakfast taco is an important part of it. But what it has to be is a flour tortilla.
Uh-huh.
But
why?
Not a big one, because it's Tex-Mex, and one of the identifying characteristics of Tex-Mex cuisine is the flour tortilla as opposed to the corn tortilla. And that's because Tex-Mex came from a place where they were eating a lot more flour than corn, and there was a lot more European influence because it was in the Rio Grande Valley, which is now southern Texas. San Antonio is where they really made it into its own genre of food. But then it gets tricky because Austin took all the credit for both Tex-Mex and more specifically for the breakfast taco. And San Antonians are like permanently outraged by this.
Well, just on the face of it, I would think it would be easier to eat a burrito because it's all wrapped up.
Yeah.
Things aren't spilling out all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the people who responded to me on Twitter, Adrian Kelt, said that breakfast burritos are compact and transportable. You can carry them on a walk with coffee. Sure. Yeah, that could be an important element to some people.
Or in your car.
Yeah.
As you're driving along.
Absolutely.
You can have it in your hand.
Absolutely. I would say that the beauty of the breakfast taco, and I think what Angelinos are sort of cottoning onto, is that you can order three. You can't really order three breakfast burritos and save face, but you can order a lot of breakfast tacos. And that way you get all the flavors. And that's a real delight.
That is a real delight.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So examples of places that have these now.
The breakfast tacos. Mm-hmm. I would say that a restaurant in Los Feliz called Home State really kicked it off. They opened up a few years ago. Lines are still around the block. It's absolute madness because it's a new treat that Los Angeles didn't invent but really has glommed onto in a big way. They have a couple different options. They have like the Trinity, which is this actually four important ingredients, even though they call it the Trinity. It's the eggs, which is sort of the base, and then the cheese, the bacon, and the potato. They have a Pecos, which is brisket and egg. Brisket is also another important element of Texan cuisine. And the Frio, which is refried beans and bacon. So there's a couple different elements there.
But why can't that all just be in a burrito and easier to hold?
Well, you know, I think that there is something not even American, but specifically Californian about wanting everything just in one easy place right in front of our face. And I don't know, maybe Texans are actually more delicate than Californians when it comes down to it.
Maybe so. Maybe so. So breakfast burrito.
Yes.
Where would you go for one of those?
Okay, so the breakfast burrito, the reason why it's so popular in Los Angeles, again, is a little bit of a mystery, because both San Francisco and Santa Fe, New Mexico can both claim that they invented it, but Angelino's really grabbed onto it. Hot off the grill in Seal Beach, they have a pastrami breakfast burrito, which tastes good and I love just sort of philosophically because it embraces two ingredients that like Angelino's really love. Mm-hmm. And then there's Lucky Boy, which is legendary.
And that's in Pasadena.
Yeah, they've got a couple locations. The standard one comes with bacon. I've had it many, many times and it's just comfort food. And not to denigrate the beauty and the art of the breakfast burrito, but a lot of people do enjoy its hangover curing properties.
You're really outing yourself now. Many, many times, huh?
For various reasons.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. All right. So that's where you go for the best burrito is Lucky Boy.
Yes. And if you wanted to switch it up again, if you wanted to go back and forth between the taco and the burrito, you could Bar Ama downtown. Their weekend brunch has a variety of breakfast tacos. And little known fact, Guisados, which is kind of a cult taco favorite, if you go in there in the morning and they haven't yet run out of eggs, they will fix you up a breakfast taco.
I didn't even know they were open in the mornings.
Yeah, so many secrets unveiled.
It's crazy. Your breakfast hangover remedy.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Guisados. Oh my gosh, what's next?
Tune in next time.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, that's a good cliffhanger right there. Catherine Spires, food editor at the LA Weekly. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jolly Myers is here now with a listener feedback.
Right. First, something very controversial. I think you should be able to put anything in a taco or a burrito. I don't think there should be rules. I'm a taco anarchist. You should be able to do anything you want.
Watch out.
You should be able to put a taco inside of a burrito and enjoy it that way.
Like a turducken.
Like a turducken. It's a taquerito. Nope.
Nope.
Nope. I'll workshop that one later. So you might be interested in eating a taco inside of a burrito once legal weed comes in November.
Nice segue. Yes.
Well,
need to workshop that one.
Thank you. I redeemed myself. We had some listeners weigh in on whether or not they're going to be voting yes on Prop 64 that would legalize recreational weed for people over the age of 21. Josh Parker says that it's an easy yes vote for him. It will bring in a lot more tax money and the regulations will keep weed out of the hands of little kids, which is something that people who are against it are a little bit worried about. Annie L. Liberty says that it's really time to decriminalize marijuana. It's just common sense. She's voting yes on 64 and hopes to end the absurd war on drugs, which has been a massive failure. If you want to weigh in on legalizing medical marijuana, nope, that's already legal. Legalizing marijuana, you can
recreational
marijuana, you can weigh in KCRW Press Play.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jolie Myers. Enjoy your taco.
Always.
Earned it. All right. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.